My name is Robert Smith. I'm the Managing Director of the International Center for Law and Religion Studies. We're grateful to have all of you here. We've enjoyed the presentations thus far and appreciate all those who've come and assisted with us. I'd like to take the opportunity now to introduce our two panelists for this afternoon's session.
Religious freedom participants, we're ready to start our next session. We hope you enjoyed your ice cream break. Please come in for our next rooms. Thank you.
Okay. we'd like to welcome and we're grateful that the Honorable J. Stuart Adams would join us. He's the majority whip in the Utah State Senate, and he's served for 4.5 years previously at the Utah House of Representatives. He's had various assignments in his legislative capacity, but significantly for purposes of this conference, he was the sponsor and lead negotiator for the three religious liberties bills that created the Utah Compromise. He has worked tirelessly in this effort and has become a resource for other legislators around the country as they grapple with these issues and look to him for leadership in going forward in their own states. We also want to welcome Professor Wilson. Robin Wilson was with us last year at this time for our conference and presented an important presentation on the arguing for the compromise between gay rights and religious freedom, which was antecedent to the efforts in the Utah legislature. Those comments proved prescient and important to the things that followed, and she came out and worked tirelessly for weeks with Senator Adams in those efforts. She's the author of several books that are important on these topics and has been very active in working in Utah and in other states on this issue of compromise. And she's also a keen observer of what is coming next, and which is the issue for our panelists. We are very grateful for the opportunity now to look forward to the legislative efforts that will be confronting all the states over this next year and in the years to come. And please welcome both Senator Adams and Professor Wilson.
Again, it's great to be with you, and I appreciate the efforts of those that put on the conference. It's for me, it's been very educational, very helpful, and very productive. And I believe what we accomplished last year was a result of the efforts that many of you in this room helped with during their legislative session. I may put a slide up here. It's kind of colorful. It's, you know, 4th of July. I think there's maybe some white on it, red, white, and blue. But try to make sense of what the colors are. The red, and for that matter, the blue, represent the RFRA bills that were actually introduced this last year. There have been many over the period of time, but this is just a snapshot as to what happened last year. There were 27 bills in 17 states, about a 17% success rate. Now, that doesn't sound too horribly bad, but it's pretty poor. But even at that, the 17% success can be represented by the blue on the map, perhaps, that the RFRAs were actually, or amendments to RFRAs were passed in Louisiana, Arkansas, and Indiana. Well, it didn't actually pass in Louisiana. The legislature couldn't pass it. You remember that? Governor Jindal, Bobby Jindal, actually put it in place by executive order. And his executive order wasn't being maybe debated and contested now because they wonder if he could actually do it. Then he actually is receiving that debate or that challenge as to whether he really had the power to do it by executive order. And then you've got in Louisiana IBM that basically had production of a new facility there that basically stopped the groundbreaking and put pressure on him. Kind of a disaster in Louisiana. Arkansas, there was an effort to pass it. I think they finally passed a watered-down bill. The governor wouldn't sign it, asked the legislature to come back and reconsider it. You know, difficult process. Anybody want to tell me what happened in Indiana? I mean, there were, it was pretty much a disaster from day one. I don't think there were any question about, you stand for principle to try to do what's right, but in reality, I think what they did and how they came back around and tried to fix what they did was even challenging. So I might rate the success rate at quite a bit lower than 17 and probably even below that. So if you want to look at what happened with RFRAs. So as we look out into the future, we talked a little bit in some of the last sessions, but I think this graph depicts probably what is going to be difficult to do or what may not be the way to go is to try to move with a RFRA bill. But rather, the Utah Compromise, which we've talked about before in the next slide, had specific protections that I believe, as we look forward, are probably the way to go. Not only the specific protections, but trying to find somewhat of a fairness for all, balanced approach, finding compassion, showing compassion, and trying to show respect for those on both sides of the issue. And as some of you may not have been in the previous sessions, but to recap very quickly, we provided protections for employers, required reasonable accommodations in grooming and dress standards and in facilities, a lock on a door. We gave them protections to control speech at work, protected employee and small businesses under 15. We gave them protection for employees or individuals. They can, if a speech is allowed at work, they can speak regarding their religious or marriage beliefs at work, protections outside of the workplace against marriage and family speech. And we gave broad protections to religious organizations, Boy Scouts affiliates, religious schools, BYU, landlord protections, and of course the balanced protections of LGBT community with housing and employment. We protected all that with non-severability, and we actually dealt with the marriage issue again, giving clerks the ability to step off, but mandating that they had to be the marrier of last resort. And we protected very, very clearly in non-professional settings people's licenses against government retaliation. So the next slide shows two different baby headlines. One is the Salt Lake Tribune, which is a Utah newspaper. And Jeff Edwards and I think Mel Levitt, who is involved in EDC Utah and the Governor's Economic Development Corporation, they basically had an opt-in. The headline was, Utah anti-discrimination law is key to recruiting quality workers. And truly, I've heard from both of them individually, and it has been key and significant as far as economic development in the state of Utah. The Indy Star, I don't know the Indy Star very well, but I assume it's a newspaper in Indiana, but their headline was Boycott Bans and Growing Backlash. And so you can see that as you look out into the future, it may not take anybody that's really, really smart to figure out which way you want to go or what the future is as far as legislation in other states. And we've heard some, quite a bit of information today. I think previously Quinn Monson and others talked about the change of the religious landscape. This slide actually depicts that. You see that the perhaps the religious association declining. The gray bar there is the unaffiliate increasing or inclining. And maybe the next slide, somewhat the same thing as to the college graduation affiliations of those that graduate from college. And then the next slide is basically the shift in public attitudes about same-sex marriage. You see in 2003, very low percentages of acceptance by society, and yet in 2013, it's very high. But one thing I maybe like you to think about for a second is that it doesn't matter whether you affiliate or you're not, or whether what your opinion is. I think most people on either side of the issue, they understand what fair is. And if you can find the right thing to do or a fair approach, that is what I think the future needs to depict. Final slide here, maybe there's a picture of some bill signings. There we go. Indiana, kind of a rough group there. I don't think any, a few people may have been smiling, I don't know, but it was a tough event. I know it was a tough day. But then on the other side, Utah, it was standing room only and a difficult process, but the results were sustainable in my mind. And both sustainable, doing the right thing, and again, we talked in previous sessions, I'll be happy to drill down further into it as to the balance that was struck, the fairness that was tried to be reached, and the process we went through of trying to be inclusive to allow stakeholders from both sides to be able to be at the table, I think are, at least in my mind, a depiction of what should be done elsewhere and what might be able to be done in the future. So finally, what I would say is that finding a balanced approach and achieving fairness for all is probably the most important legislative principle to use as we look forward to specific legislation. And I'm sure there'll be some comments. There are some particular pieces of legislation that have been talked about around the nation, and we'd be happy to take those during question and answer. We've had a great discussion in some of the previous sessions and look forward to answering those questions and hope to have, again, a great discussion later. Thank you.
Okay, so I want to spend a few minutes contrasting the Utah Compromise with what came before. And what I mean by that is the experience of states that voluntarily embraced same-sex marriage. So we know just now, what, a week and a half ago, the Supreme Court extended the right to marry to same-sex couples. And in a lot of ways, the decision was anticlimactic. So after last November's denial of cert or the prerogative to review a decision, same-sex marriage had already washed across most of the country, including Utah, which flipped from being red, no same-sex marriage, to being blue almost overnight. So what we're seeing is sort of the trailing edge of that. And that's important because some of how this is going to shake out ultimately we already know. For example, we know that the Utah Compromise is holding, and as I will try to convince you, the Utah Compromise delivers more protection to marriage and to religious objectors than any state in the country. And had Utah waited, I think that would be a tougher sell, and I think people would have caught themselves flat-footed in the way that people in Mississippi and Alabama and Texas and all the rest of the country are finding themselves. So, now, like Utah, many states are considering what to do against a backdrop of involuntary same-sex marriage. And they need a battery of protections, what I call the core protections, that have been adopted in the states that voluntarily embrace same-sex marriage, which you can see in this summary chart. And I'm happy to give you guys a link to download this because I know it's hard to read. But the left-hand side is the 297 statute that Senator Adams has been touching on. It gives what I call marriage conscience protections. I'll explain those in a second. The right-hand side talks about 296. That's the LGBT rights part, which also has in it very innovative religious liberty protections that, again, are holding. Now, as I said, you need a battery of core protections like those adopted in the voluntary same-sex marriage states. 297 included every single one of those, with the exception of one, which was adoption. Adoption, there can be religious views used only for ecclesiastical purposes. I'm happy in comments to talk about why I think that was a tragedy and it should have been stronger. But with the exception of that, every voluntary same-sex marriage protection appears in Utah, and then there are more. So if a religious group, for example, did religious counseling in traditional marriages before same-sex marriage in the voluntary states and in Utah, it can do so after. So think about the Baptist marriage retreat. I don't know if we have any Baptists, but apparently they love to have marriage retreats. Not my idea of a good time. I don't particularly want to go. But if you do not say in the law that the Baptists can have Baptist marriage counseling, that's for Baptists and traditional heterosexual marriage, you can be assured of the fact that somebody will sue you because they will want to go, if not for any other reason than make a point. These laws say that that is not within the ambit of the sexual orientation non-discrimination statutes. 297 also says, as the voluntary same-sex marriage states did, that if you want to limit your grounds and property only to hosting marriage receptions for marriages that are consistent with your faith, you could do that before same-sex marriage, you can do that after. Now, every state to enact a same-sex marriage law voluntarily, and Utah in the compromise, also in the very first column, the one that has the most check marks, say this: clergy only have to marry people that they want to marry in their sanctuary. Now, that was, and apologies to the Senator Adams, wholly unnecessary, because the First Amendment guarantees that right. And con law professors, if you poll them, cannot get agreement on any other thing except this. But even they can agree that the First Amendment says the clergy do not have to marry people in the sanctuary that they don't want to marry. The whole fight, in fact, is outside the sanctuary. It's all the rest of that chart on 297. It is whether you have your tax exemption placed at risk, whether you can contract with the state, whether you're going to be sued civilly by gay people or any other person for refusing somehow to facilitate their marriage. Now, as I said, those are the pressing questions. Utah differed from the voluntary states in one important respect. It did not ban sexual orientation discrimination in statewide law in any context before marriage was recognized, whether that was in housing, hiring, or public accommodations. But all the voluntary same-sex marriage states do, and many of the states around the country that are dealing with the marriage decision have sexual orientation non-discrimination bans either in statewide law or, as in Arizona, in municipal law. And the reason that matters is that when you have sexual orientation discrimination bans first and marriage second, many of the collisions over same-sex marriage are teed up not by the marriage part, but by the sexual orientation non-discrimination laws. So, for example, in states with sexual orientation non-discrimination bans, before you recognized marriage, you could, quote, discriminate on the basis of marital status. In other words, you could say, I'm going to place these kids for adoption only with married families. That was legal all day long because gay folks could not marry. It's after you add marriage to that equation that all of a sudden there is a live issue about whether you can continue to place children with heterosexual married families. What the voluntary states, some of them do, is to say yes to that question on adoption. Utah did not. But the point that I'm making is that these collisions come from the sexual orientation non-discrimination statutes themselves and from the fact that they were not artfully tailored to the idea that marriage is a religious sacrament. It is not, for many, many people, it is not like any other commercial service. So these non-discrimination bans, as I say, are about burgers and taxis and large apartment buildings, commercial services. And the careful duty of legislatures like Utah's is to make clear in these statutes that those sexual orientation protections, which are important and worthy, were never meant to spill over to marriage. Now, as I said, Utah sort of had marriage first, sexual orientation, non-discrimination second. And here, the task of balancing religious liberty and gay rights in some ways is more challenging. It's more challenging because when marriage is not voluntary, and there is no sexual orientation non-discrimination ban, it's like the electorate is not really ready for the question. That's where most of America is right now. They have never thought about what's involved in protecting a sexual minority. And we talked in the last session about locks on the doors, you know, for bathrooms. How are you going to make this work out? They haven't thought about those questions. And neither have they thought about how to extend access to marriage without hurting religious dissenters. So that's challenge one. It's also more challenging when you have marriage first and sexual orientation second for another reason. So for example, in public accommodations, we've heard a lot around the country about bakers and florists and photographers. These people can deny services to anyone they choose to right now. So, and I think it's wrong, by the way. So you guys probably saw in Tennessee that we had a hardware store that posted a sign, no gays allowed, right? Now, I think that's wrong. Tell people you shouldn't come to their hardware store because they're gay. Who cares? They're buying a hammer, right? It doesn't matter. I think it's also wrong to fire a kid for going to a gay rights parade when he serves hamburgers for a living. Again, who cares? But I also believe that non-discrimination bans should not extend to facilitating marriages, because marriage is a sacrament for many people, and it's been a religious institution long before it was a civil one. So people should be able to step aside from facilitating that. Now, the reason this is a challenge is because the lack of protection for LGBT people in statewide law, which is sorely needed, means that religious objectors today will win any collisions over same-sex marriage, at least in public marketplace. Because today, 28 states give no such protection in statewide law, although some municipalities do. Now, that means if religious objectors would win today, why should religious groups and institutions follow Utah's example and extend protections in hiring and housing, or go further and extend them in public accommodations? And I think the answer is, first, compromise allows legislatures to make clear that marriage is in fact a sacrament for many, that they should be able to step off for facilitating that for other people, as long as they don't block access to the institution of marriage. Second, the fact is the state has a number of levers to pull on to get you to gay rights whether you want to go or not, dragging and screaming. And those levers I've already mentioned, municipal bans, for example, which is what the core protections are all responding to by saying those bans were not, anti-discrimination statutes were never meant to apply to marriage. We heard this morning about the threat to tax-exempt status of religious organizations that gives the state tremendous power. The Solicitor General, in fact, opened this can of worms in oral argument on the Obergefell decision, said it would certainly be an issue. Question whether the feds would use tax exemption to force the hands of religious objectors until they're in a distinct minority, as Doug Laycock said. But when the Solicitor General of the United States raises it, you should pay attention. Religious organizations also contract with the state, which means that that itself, that right to contract with the state, can be used to push a different view, one that religious organizations aren't comfortable with. Religious organizations and individuals hold professional licenses. In fact, that's one of the reasons that part of the innovation in the Utah Compromise is to say that if you say something on Sunday as a stake president, you can't lose your professional license on Monday for having done so. There's an important reason that they address that, because licensure and accreditation is the way to force religious groups to heal. We also see at the federal level that the EEOC has taken the position that sex discrimination includes sexual orientation discrimination, and the Department of Justice is going to follow that lead. Again, a reason to compromise rather than to wait. And then finally, we have the state employing some potential objectors, like marriage clerks. Also something very innovative done in Utah as to that I'll talk about in just a second. So there are reasons that legislatures, I think, need to embrace compromise. As I've said, I think extending rights to the LGBT community is good and decent. But it's not only decent, it presents the opportunity to clarify that same-sex marriage should not be used to extinguish a religious view of marriage. So, Utah replicated all the voluntary same-sex marriage accommodations used elsewhere except for the adoption social services one in a handful of states. And then it had these four innovations: scope limitations, new speech protections for professionals, parity provisions I'll talk about, and then a structure for solemnization that just bypasses religious objectors entirely. On scope, Utah's anti-discrimination statute previously exempted sole corporations, think the Mormon Church, wholly owned subsidiaries, think BYU, and small employers with less than 15 employees. But that was insufficient in the view of the legislature. So they ballooned those exemptions to include the Boy Scouts of America, which I sort of see as part of the DNA of Utah, to include religious affiliates, think BYU Housing as an employer, and they included, and this is really important, religious institutions and societies and educational institutions. And that's a place where I think the Mormons were not just looking out for the Mormons. This included lots of evangelical, freestanding, and Protestant mainline schools. In fact, 57 in total. Now, together, those scope limitations make clear that the LGBT protections can coexist with religious liberty, and that they don't have to wash out the religious character of religious communities. Quick word about speech protections, and then I'll wrap up. So you can't lose your professional license, as I said, for saying something on Sunday when you walk in on Monday. There are also parity protections for religious and political speech about family, marriage, and sexuality, both inside the workplace and outside. For speech outside the workplace, think Brendan Eich. You can't be fired for giving $1,000 to Prop 8 7 years before, and neither can you be fired like the kid who worked at Red Robins, who went to an Equality Utah or some other gay rights parade. Neither one of those things is relevant to your job, shouldn't happen. Within the workplace, religious speech is given equal protection to political speech. Employers don't have to allow either for essential business purposes, as the senator pointed out, but if they do, they have to treat them the same way. So I can wear my Equality Utah pin right next to my cross. Now this is important going forward, because it sets up and satisfies a goalpost that has been established by one of the mainline gay rights groups, the Human Rights Campaign. Human Rights Campaign takes the position that gay people have to be treated just like black people. In other words, the exemptions or the rules that you have as religious groups with respect to race have to be identical with respect to sexual orientation. That by itself is a challenge, but Utah pulled it off. Now, most important, I think, as I said at the beginning, I want to emphasize it again, Utah delivered more protections on the question of marriage and to religious objectors and religious organizations than any state in the country, and they're holding. Now, one last point, and I'll stop. The canary in the mine. So even in those states that don't have sexual orientation non-discrimination laws and statewide law, the canary in the mine will be the marriage clerk. That is the reason we are seeing Alabama shut down marriage offices entirely. That's the reason we're seeing resignations in Mississippi. And that will be true in every state in America that did not already have voluntary same-sex marriage. Why? Because the state has monopoly power on marriage. Now, I personally believe that the state cannot shut down access to marriage as a way to solve this religious objection. That would be no different than Orville Faba standing on the front steps of the Little Rock, Arkansas High School and saying to black kids, y'all can't come in here. Right? That should be unacceptable to us when the court has just said that the right to marry is a fundamental right. So how did Utah deal with that? It bypassed the problem entirely. First, it created a duty in state law that the state will always provide a form of last resort to be married. That was never a part of Utah law before the compromise. So someone now has to be available to marry anyone who presents. But the clerk's office can outsource that duty to any authorized celebrant in the community. That can be a clergy member, a judge, any other person. And if they can't find anybody, then the town clerk, an elected official, has to do that service. And I don't really have a whole lot of problem with that, because they can resign at the end of the day. But it seems that the Utah Compromise has made it possible for this to be satisfied without any town clerks having to resign, as far as I know. Senator, correct me if I'm wrong. So what happens is employees of the clerk's offices are taken out of the loop, and they cannot be fired if they adhere to a traditional view of marriage, and neither do they have to resign in advance. So I think that that's remarkable, that Utah, the second most religious state in America, delivered more protections to the LGBT community than they have in New York. And at the same time, they locked down protections for religious people. And there are lots of those here, too.
Thank you both very much. Now we want to take some questions and focus our attention on, they've given you a great background and some things that they might be looking forward to in the future that we can grapple with. Go ahead. And we have a question up here, one right here, and then we'll get down here.
Robin, can you talk more about adoption? Say something you didn't say so far.
Do you want to collect?
We'll collect a few comments. Let's see. Down here. Right here. And then I think someone else has the microphone over here. Yes, go ahead.
For Robin, I'm curious if you followed at all the conversation surrounding federal non-discrimination legislation and whether or not you see that as having some implications for states and how it might affect conversations about state-level legislation.
Gail?
I mean, talk about the fact that, you know, this is a good example to take into other states, but Earlier, the senator referred to bringing both sides together and what Utah did to bring both sides together. I have a little bit different definition of that, and I want to ask about. Both sides in this case was the church and the homosexual groups, and well, the ACLU, who represents homosexual groups. But it didn't include any of the people who normally work on this issue. For in the 5 years that the church was working on this and meeting and negotiating with the homosexual side of this, there were other people at the legislature working very hard all the time on this issue, who care desperately about this, who live and breathe it. And never were they part of any of this under any circumstances, other than at the very end, invited to a meeting to be shown the legislation and said, but don't ask to change one thing in here because we're not going to change anything. So I don't view this as bringing all the sides together. I believe that one side was completely left out. So now as you talk about taking it to other states, had this other side, and I'm part of that, and a lot of people in this room are, everybody is, it's the citizens, but some of us spend a lot of time at the Capitol. We could be part of helping to take that to other states had we been part of the negotiations and even had some input into the legislation. The church in Utah, of course, this is huge, but you get outside of the state of Utah and you'll find that these organizations, I'm part of a big, large national organization that has, you know, people in every state. But I really wasn't along with everybody else, wasn't part of this. We were just on the outside looking in and in shock because we found out about it at the end of the day and had no input. So my question would be, you know, you have the religious liberty coming up. Hopefully Senate leadership's going to support that. Where do all the rest of us fit into this picture? And if we're going to take this into other states, how do we become a real part of it? Not just saying, here, I want you to see the legislation because I know this is important to you.
Why don't we take those three questions, starting, I think, with adoption question.
So, I have a lot to say about adoption. But on this, I have a very colored perspective because I'm an adopted child. But let me tell you first how Utah didn't do as well as the voluntary same-sex marriage states here. So inserted in that adoption protection, which mirrors the voluntary same-sex marriage states, was a caveat. It said you can have your religious view about social services, foster care services, adoption services, quote, for ecclesiastical purposes only, which means not civil effects. Okay, the other states, and these aren't exactly super, they're not like super religious states like Minnesota, actually said you could place children for adoption with traditional heterosexual couples if you did that before the marriage, voluntary marriage rule, and you can do it after. Three of the four states said, but only if you don't take public monies, so state, federal or local monies for that program. One of the four, Rhode Island, said you could do it even if you take public monies. Now, I think Rhode Island gets it right, because if you tie it only to public money, right, then you, in effect, are creating an economic death penalty for that program. 70% of Catholic Charities' budget, for example, at least in the state of Maryland, which extended one of these exemptions, but only if you didn't take public money in the program, 70% of their budget came from those federal, state, or local dollars. Now, I don't think we want to do that. I think we want to have a rich diversity of organizations in our society, some of whom serve in place with traditional heterosexual families, so long as we have a plethora of people that are willing to serve in gay couples, right? My first commitment as an adopted child is I want every child to have a permanent commitment to a family and not to be stranded in foster care, for example, as long as every person who wants to make this gift to a child is able to have access to it. But I understand optically why that's a hard sell, because you're taking public money, but you're not living by a public rule. That's gonna be the tough problem. Utah didn't even get that far on it. Can I take the question about the federal ENDA?
Yeah, go ahead.
On the federal ENDA, so you do have, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act bounced around Congress for like a decade, finally passed Senate, as you know, last before Hobby Lobby, and then 5 days after Hobby Lobby, the gay rights groups yanked their support for ENDA. ENDA is completely off the table now. It did have a robust religious liberty exemption that's a little bit better than Title VII, I'm told, and it's gone. And now the federal gay rights groups, as I understand, or gay rights groups operating at the federal level, are taking the position that they want an all-in protection, so public accommodations, housing, and hiring. And watching the Utah Compromise go by, even just doing housing and hiring is really hard. To do public accommodations, too, for sexual orientation is going to be a really massive, massive hill to climb. So I think that means, for the moment, that the federal efforts are stalled, unless I'm missing something. And I don't know what they mean for the state efforts. The one thing that does mean something for the state efforts is the fact that the EEOC and the Department of Justice are taking the position that sex discrimination includes sexual orientation discrimination or sexual identity discrimination. That may moot the need for an all-in compromise.
Trade your mics here. Gail, appreciate the comment, appreciate the question. In order to understand that, I think we need to have a little background. I got into this issue in more detail about a year ago. We had, in the Utah State Legislature, we had a lot of efforts going on right after Judge Shelby ruled in December of 2013 that we had same-sex marriage. We had SB 100, which was a piece of legislation that Senator Urquhart was running. And we had Senator Stuart Reed pushing, among others, religious liberties protections. And Senator Reed then, right after legislative session, we held all the bills last year, 2 years ago, not last legislative session, but in the 2014 legislative session, because we hadn't had a Supreme Court or even an appeal process ruling. So we weren't sure what landscape we were dealing with. So we held both the religious liberties and the non-discrimination bills. Having done that, Stuart Reed was pretty much the go-to guy in the Senate, but he decided he wasn't going to run again. So I started spending some time with Stuart Reed about this time last year. Spent a good deal of time with him trying to figure out how to move forward religious liberties in the state of Utah. There's no secret in the state of Utah, there's 24 of 29 senators that are Republican, 63 out of 75 Republicans in the House. We can do whatever pretty much we want to if we choose to. And we'd had discussions. Senator Urquhart had come and presented his non-discrimination bill to our Senate caucus. There was zero support for it. I think that is too secretive, that there was no support to move any type of anti-discrimination legislation through the legislature. Our feeling was perhaps it was going to come out of rules, maybe go into a committee, but it probably didn't matter what committee we sent it to. It probably wasn't going to go anywhere. The second day of the legislative session, the LDS Church came forward and wanted us to combine two efforts. Again, we have a 45-day legislative session. That's total days, 33 work days. They made the announcement with 31 work days left. And to try to combine these two pieces of legislation was horrific and quite a monumental task. Part of that task was actually moving and trying to get consensus on granting rights to the LGBT community. When we were asked to combine it, that was a very, very difficult process of trying to find that fairness for all in housing and employment. As we moved through that process, we tried to be as inclusive and tried, I think, to make sure that everyone was involved. And the bottom line is, I think we heard earlier today, if I remember the vote count right, we had of the 29 senators, there were 24 that voted for it. So it was, and at the House there were 65 to 10. So there were 10 that voted against it. 5 voted against in the Senate, 10 in the House. But I can tell you, the last week of the session. Again, we have a short legislative session, but my day consisted of, I think, the Wednesday before. This is maybe a snapshot of one day, trying to be as inclusive as I can. I spent 7 o'clock with the Conservative Caucus in the House, spent from noon to 2 with Robin with the General Caucus in the House, and then I spent most of the evening in a House committee hearing. We tried to be as inclusive, to try to bring everyone along. Those House and Senate committee hearings were open to the public. We had great input, and Gail, I know you were there, part of it. Appreciated your help. It was a short period of time, but at the end of the day, I believe that we were inclusive, that we reached out to everyone possible. We may not have seen things exactly eye to eye, but in the end of the day, I think it was an inclusive process. And I do believe in the future, if we don't do that, I mean, I showed this slide here up on the screen, but the RFRAs that were passed across the nation, or tried to pass, it often wasn't successful. But as we looked at specific exemptions, as Robin's talked about, as she talked about the difference between a RFRA and actually having those specific protections, we know that they're actually better. So if you have a better protection and you have a more likelihood of passage, which way are you going to go? You're going to look for the effort that it looks like Indiana or Arizona, or you're going to try to find something like Utah. And it wasn't a perfect process. We tried our best, but appreciate those comments, and we're looking forward. We're trying to open up dialogue even today and even later today, that we're trying to bring people in to be part of the process. And there was probably no effort to be exclusive, but I'll tell you what, in 31 days, there wasn't much time for sleep.
We have a little bit of time for a few more questions. There's a question up in the back there. Gentleman in the middle section. Is there anyone else? And over here.
Hi, my name's Kevin Worthy. I'm a lawyer here in Provo. My question is directed mostly towards Robin, I guess, but also towards Senator Adams. And I want to say this in a non-inflammatory way. I'm not trying to inflame anyone's passions. But Robin, you talked about the things that are happening in Mississippi and in some other states. People are very upset about what the Supreme Court has done with respect to same-gender marriages. And I look at that, and I believe I'm in agreement, essentially, with John Roberts and some of the other justices on the court, in that I see what the majority did as a very significant abuse of their power. And so I see the actions that people are taking in Mississippi as a response to this very significant abuse. And it's really hard for me to understand why you would say that that response, that civilly disobedient response to the Supreme Court's abuse, it's very significant abuse of its power. How is that like some kind of strange, horrible, racist thing that happened in Alabama, I guess it was, years ago, because people in Alabama have so much hatred towards blacks that they didn't want them to attend college. And so I'm curious as to how you are thinking about that and why you say that those are similar things.
Okay, thank you for that question. Go ahead.
You talked about the federal legislation, but what about state by state? What states are considering this Utah Compromise, and what efforts are we making to help influence those decisions?
Okay, why don't we go ahead?
Kevin, I hear what you're saying. I get it. Let me just say, to talk about two different kinds of civil disobedience. One is clergy members who are saying we should all be prepared to go to jail. Okay, that's a civil disobedience I completely get. Wholly unnecessary, because nobody's going to be made to go to jail for not opening their sanctuary to a marriage they can't recognize. So as I said in a recent blog post on the Berkeley Center Cornerstone site, which you're welcome to look at, there are real threats to religious liberty, and then there's just misunderstandings about the nature of the law. So one thing I want to do in this task is to talk about those things that are real and those things that aren't, okay? The second piece of civil disobedience are the marriage offices themselves. So an arm of the state saying no when the highest court of the land has said yes. Now, I understand deeply why people don't think same-sex marriage should have been done this way, that it feels anti-democratic, right? It feels like Roe, right? I get that. But if the state has monopoly power on marriage, which these offices do, and if the highest court of the land says you have to do this, then that's where I draw the line. And I think that's no different than the racial discrimination case that I talked about on the heels of Brown, where the highest court of the land says we are going to integrate our schools, and you have the governor of Arkansas saying no. You were talking about George Wallace, same idea though, right? So it's a conflict, it's separation of powers problem, right? The highest court of the land has said this is what marriage is. We can detest it, not like it, but if the state has monopoly power on marriage, it's just, for me, like the schools being integrated.
Let's go to what states are looking at this, or what states are talking about it, and maybe to give a little background there too. As we look out and see what's happened around the nation with Indiana, Arkansas, Louisiana, others, we see a setting that Utah, for whatever reason, we had our same-sex marriage, our when we stood together, locked arms, and did a constitutional amendment in the 2002 era, and defined marriage between a man and a woman, as Judge Shelby overturned that. We were in the same position last legislative session as the rest of the country is in today. And so we find the Supreme Court has ruled for them what we had through Shelby's ruling. So what we did in the last legislative session applies to the rest of the country today after last week. Every point that we passed, every point that we went through in the last two sessions, those protections that were given, religious liberties protections, now can apply to every other state in the nation. So it's very significant, your question, as to who else is looking, because there are states that don't know how to deal with marriage. You see, as Robin indicated, a clerk of Mississippi quitting her job. She won't issue a marriage license. She now is mandated to, doesn't want to do it, she walks off the job. I mean, that's a horrible thing to happen. That won't happen in Utah. I mean, Davis County, they won't marry. We've given them the ability to clerk to step off, but we've given them the mandate to marry, but they give a mandate by giving a list of other people that will marry. They see a sense of relief as people come into that clerk's office having that list. So the states that are talking to us, obviously we have Intermountain states, Idaho, Arizona, we have states back east, Ohio, Indiana we spent a lot of time with, having gone through that process. North Carolina tried to do our marriage step off. The governor vetoed it. The House and the Senate had to override it. We spent a lot of time with North Carolina. We're hearing from Iowa. We had another bill we haven't talked about that Iowa tried to pass that was unsuccessful there. Talks to North Carolina. We've had talks with a lot of people around the nation, but quite frankly, as you look at it again, the effort of trying to get specific exemptions and protections and to try to do it in amicable fashion, I think, is the future. And there are many states, and I think as we reach out, that the challenge that I would have, if Utah is the only one with these significant religious protections, these specific protections, I'm a little concerned as to how long they last. And if we don't reach out to other states, I think it's a mistake. I think the old concept that Madison talked about, the bundle of grapes, if you stay together, you have a lot of protection and power. But if you get picked off one at a time, you lose that. I think that's been the course of history. And I think we need to continue to band together to try to move what Utah did forward, because I think it can be applied to other states.
Well, we'll have to call it there. Thank you very much. Let's give a round of applause for our panelists. Okay, so at this point, we have all are invited. But we have a session on civility. This is a session that is particularly for lawyers who are required to have continuing legal education. It'll be held in this room by Professor Elizabeth Clark. But you're all welcome. Okay. We'll have a short break while we get prepared.
I'd rather have questions.
Oh, I'm sorry. Would you like to use it?
Yes, that would be lovely. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to steal your computer.
Sorry, I thought I was going to help.
No. I have my. It's been on
Senator Adams.
The tricky part is just. Oh, but this is an apple, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm not sure.
I'll be ready.
I think. Okay, we'll be ready.
But I'll talk to you. Battery reach critical level.
Let's see what we can do.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate that. Thank you. Last time I was at the conference center, they had their own setup. But I can probably call up BYU setup. It is on, where's the remote drive?
Not coming up.
Oh, there's that. It's the latest one. Yeah, that one.